When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Get in zone, AutoZone. Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Brakes? We can save you 15% on that. We have OE quality Duralast brake pads and rotors in stock, ready for pickup or delivery. We also have calipers, brake fluid, tools, and anything else you'll need to do the job right. When you get Duralast pads and rotors together, you'll save 15%. It's just part of what makes us America's number one brakes destination. Get in zone,
AutoZone. Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my new series, Parrish. My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life. You know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC+.
Where Were You in 92 is a production of iHeartRadio.
You know, I always say success is the best revenge.
Welcome to Where Were You in 92, a podcast in which I, your host, Jason Lanfier, look back at the major hits, one-hit wonders, shocking news stories, and irresistible scandals that shaped what might be the wildest, most eclectic, most controversial 12 months of music ever. This week, Vanessa Williams' Grammy-nominated smash, Save the Best for Last, spent 5 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100, became her signature song, and remains an adult contemporary staple. But it also marked a redemptive turning point for the first Black Miss America, whose reputation had been tarnished in 1984 when she gave up her title after Penthouse published unauthorized nude photos of her taken before her participation in the pageant. In this episode, we explore how the singer-actress overcame betrayal, bigotry, and public ridicule to stage one of the most memorable comebacks in entertainment history. Plus, Vanessa Williams herself joins us to discuss how a single photo shoot and then a massive hit single changed her life forever. Sometimes the snow comes down in June. Do you remember back in episode one when I declared that the opening line of Sir Mix-a-Lot's 1992 hit, Baby Got Back, Oh My God, Becky, Look at Her Butt, may be one of the most unforgettable opening lines in pop history? Well, Sometimes the Snow Comes Down in June is right up there too. It, along with Oh My God, Becky, was certainly one of the most famous lines to come out of 1992. Vanessa Williams' Save the Best for Last, the song that Snow Comes Down in June line comes from, spent 5 weeks at number one that year, becoming Williams' first and only song to top the Billboard Hot 100. Funny coincidence? A few months later, Baby Got Back also spent 5 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100, becoming Sir Mix-a-Lot's first and only song to top that chart. The lesson here, folks, when attempting to write a number one pop song, kick things off with a doozy. While it's not quite a shocked Valley girl commenting on some random woman's booty, Sometimes the Snow Comes Down in June is kind of a weird, intriguing way to start a song if you think about it. When I heard it as a kid, I was as befuddled as that Valley girl. Snow in June? Impossible. Of course, now I've learned it's totally possible. It snowed in Colorado and at Lake Tahoe on the California-Nevada border just this past June. In June 2020, heavy snow fell in the Utah mountains. Anyway, this isn't a damn weather report. I'm just saying it happens. Strange things happen. Which is what that line is about. As well as the song's more suspicious second line. Sometimes the sun goes round the moon. Sometimes crazy shit happens. Sometimes life surprises us, for better or for worse. Vanessa Williams knows this. She has been through it. Seen her life change quite literally overnight on more than a few occasions. By the time Williams ascended to the top of the charts in 1992, she'd already had experience taking out all the competition. In 1983, she was crowned Miss America, becoming the first Black Miss America. It was something she'd never expected, a feat she achieved almost by accident. Then, in 1984, just 2 months before her reign was set to end, she'd surrender her title after her world was rocked by scandal. She would walk away disgraced and devastated. How do you rebound from that kind of public humiliation? Well, she did, in a major way. Some would say William's comeback, like snow coming down in June, or more so, like the sun going round the moon, was a miracle. But that takes away her agency and diminishes her talent. She climbed to the summit and transcended the beauty pageant world because she refused to let her 1984 fall from grace ruin her or define her. This is her story. Vanessa Williams was born in the Bronx and raised in the Westchester County suburb of Millwood by music teacher parents. She has said she never felt beautiful growing up. In grade school, she was the only Black kid in class, which could be isolating. As an adolescent, she struggled with pimples. Her mother, Helen Williams, instilled the values of hard work and merit in her when she was young. Being pretty was great, but being talented and respected was what mattered. In the early 1980s, she attended Syracuse University, my alma mater, where she studied musical theater. During her sophomore year, a man named Bill Harmond, who was on the board of the Miss Greater Syracuse pageant, saw her performance in a school production of Swingin' on a Star and was blown away. He told one of her friends and classmates that he thought she had the goods to make it all the way to Miss America. Beauty Queen was not on her list of aspirations. She'd intended to graduate with a BFA, go to Yale for post-grad, and then start auditioning. But by April of her sophomore year, the director of the Miss Greater Syracuse pageant was practically beating down her door to get her to audition for the pageant. She finally sold Williams on the idea by informing her that if she won, she'd receive a $500 scholarship for her junior year. When she asked her mother for advice, she immediately told her to do it. Later, when she called her to say she'd won Miss Greater Syracuse 1983, her mom's first response was, "That's terrific. How much money did you get?" In July 1983, she headed to the Miss New York pageant. She won that too. Her life became a series of parades and county fairs and rehearsals for her next stop, the Miss America pageant. There, in Atlantic City, she'd perform Barbra Streisand's slowed-down, melodramatic version of Happy Days Are Here Again, a tune Babs had sung opposite Judy Garland in a medley of It and Get Happy during an October 1963 episode of The Judy Garland Show. So yeah, while Williams was new to the beauty queen scene, she was a total theater geek, which she concluded might work in her favor. Says Williams,
"I mean, some of these girls have been in the pageant system for their lives, and their goal is to be Miss America. And I came in from, you know, side door. And my goal in life was to be on Broadway."
As she recalls in You Have No Idea, her 2012 memoir that she wrote with her mom, quote, "Even as I would glide down the runway in high heels and a swimsuit, I would think, how did I get here? Now, how do I justify this again? Oh yeah, scholarship money for my junior year. You're an actress. Pretend this is another role. And smile." It worked. In September 1983, Williams won the title of Miss America 1984. All she could think as the rhinestone tiara was placed on her head was that she'd now have to give up studying abroad in London her junior year. But then, walking the runway right after being crowned, Williams was suddenly really proud, elated. Friends and family had bussed in to support her, and she recalls hearing her father's clapping rising above the cheers and applause. In the months that followed, she would tour the country, changing her location every 1 to 2 days. She would sign autographs, have dinner with the president and first lady, and meet Eddie Murphy and Muhammad Ali. Less than 5 months after having won Miss Greater Syracuse, 20-year-old Vanessa Williams had become the first Black Miss America in the pageant's six-decade history. You see, when it was first created in 1921 as a way to attract tourists to the Atlantic City boardwalk, the Miss America pageant had some explicit guidelines. Rule number 7, for example, stated that, quote, contestants must be of good health and of the white race. That rule wasn't abolished until 1950, but the pageant would not include a black contestant until 1970, when Miss Iowa, Sherrill Brown, competed for Miss America in 1971. When Williams won the title in 1983, Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman elected to the United States Congress, was hopeful, saying at the time, quote, "The inherent racism in America must be diluting itself." But being the first black Miss America would come with its burdens. Not everyone was as thrilled for Williams as Chisholm and her loved ones were. There were jokes, dumb and racist ones. Days after her victory, the Tonight Show host Johnny Carson addressed it in his opening monologue. "Did you hear we have the first black Miss America?" he asked. "I bet you didn't know that Mr. T was one of the judges." Williams was stunned. A week after she took the crown, letters began arriving at the Williams home. While her mother recalls reading thousands of congratulatory messages, the family also received hate mail. Some deemed Williams, quote unquote, not pure, and therefore not worthy of the title because of her race. One note read, quote, "You'll never be our Miss America." In another, someone threatened to throw acid in her face. Another included the message, "You're dead, bitch." Some of the letters were filled with spit. Others contained pubic hair and semen. After she went to the police, an FBI agent taught Williams' mother how to open the envelopes with gloves in such a way that the letters could be traced back to the senders. Some who wrote to Williams were black. As Helen Williams recalls, and you have no idea, quote, "We got letters from black people saying we were liars, that she wasn't really black. How could she be black with light skin and blue eyes? We'd go to hell for our deceptions." Both of Vanessa Williams' parents were black. Her grandparents on both sides were also black. Others condemned Williams for having a white boyfriend at the time. Says Vanessa Williams,
"To think about myself at 20 years old going through this criticism of me just trying to be a junior in college, winning this thing overnight, having no intention of actually having this as part of my career, having to deal with the not only the logistics and the schedule and the importance and the weight of the situation, but then dealing with criticism. That was, I can say it hurt my feelings at 20 years old, and it was hard to deal with."
Her mother turned many of the letters over to the police, but unhinged harassers would call the Williams home with death threats. Others would show up at their door. Not wanting to scare her while she was traveling and fulfilling her new duties, Helen kept many details from her daughter. In the South, extra security would accompany Vanessa. Armed guards stood outside her hotel room in Alabama. Extra measures were taken even when she returned to Millwood in New York, which was mostly white.
Of course, it was clear to me when we had our homecoming parade in my hometown and there was sharpshooters on the top of the buildings. And you think, wow, you know, that's a lot of protection. And then you think, oh, wow, that is a lot of protection because there is some risks.
The beauty queen perks didn't seem worth the danger. Writes Helen Williams in You Have No Idea, quote, "We had no idea her Miss America reign would quickly become a reign of terror for us. We had no idea how once it started, we couldn't wait for it to be over." Vanessa Williams' reign would be over sooner than she or her family expected. On Friday the 13th, in July 1984, just 6 weeks before her year-long tenure as Miss America was set to end, she received some startling news. She was finishing up an interview with the New York Post when the reporter told her there were rumblings that she'd appear nude in Penthouse magazine. She was confused and dumbfounded. Sure enough, about a week later, while she was signing autographs for a crowd of young black girls who idolized her at a Gillette event, she was told to call her lawyer right away. The press had gotten their hands on advanced copies of Penthouse's 15th anniversary issue. There she was on its cover, wearing a sparkly gown next to comedian George Burns, known for portraying the man upstairs in the movie Oh God, in a photo she'd taken with him at his 88th birthday party several months before. The cover line? "Miss America, Oh God, She's Nude." Inside the issue, she'd appear in a lot less. The news broke fast. The morning after the Gillette event and a very uncomfortable dinner with its execs, shit went down. Williams Hotel was packed with reporters. She and her Miss America chaperone pushed their way past the rapid-fire questioning and flashbulbs, but the paparazzi followed them all the way to the airport. On the plane, after takeoff, a man from CBS News suddenly popped up out of nowhere with a camera, asking her for comment. The tabloid headlines called her Miss America and Vanessa the Undressa. Meanwhile, Albert Marks, the pageant chairman, was totally disgusted and demanded that Williams resign within 72 hours. Didn't call her, went straight to the press. He has said, quote, "I've never seen anything like these photographs. Ugh, I can't even show them to my wife." What does that even mean? I gotta take a breath. So at this point, you might be wondering where these nude photos came from. This is one of the reasons I'm taking a breath, because so many people suck in this story. And surprise, they're all men. A year before she became Miss America, Williams was 19 and back home for the summer between semesters, working as a receptionist slash makeup artist with a local photographer. One day, after hours, he asked her to model for him with his friend for some quote-unquote artsy black and white nude silhouettes. "These are just for me," he said. "Don't worry. No one will know it's you anyway." His friend, a woman, showed up. She and Williams had some white wine, and then the pair took the photographer's commands and posed for some shots. The images were intimate and erotic. As Williams writes in her book, You Have No Idea, the photographer had become a friend. She'd met his wife and kids. "Why shouldn't I trust him?" she thought. Hugh Hefner, Playboy founder and editor-in-chief, was offered the photos first, but he turned them down out of respect for Williams. The single victim in all this was the young woman herself, whose right to make this decision was taken away from her, he said. If she wanted to make this kind of statement, that would be her business, but the statement wasn't made by her. But as Time reported, Playboy also rejected the photos because, quote, "it does not use what spokesman Dave Selyers calls lesbian material." Penthouse founder, editor, and publisher Bob Guccione did accept the photos, paying the photographer $50,000 for them. As Leslie J. Gould, the public relations director for Penthouse in the 1980s, told Esquire in 2020, quote, "Bob didn't see it the way Hefner saw it. He thought Hefner missed out on making a lot of money. Bob's way of thinking was that if he didn't publish the photos, someone else would." Google this guy and it will all make sense. He used to wear a gold chain with a penis dangling from it. Williams waited until the last hour of those 72 hours she'd been given to decide if she wanted to resign. She ultimately did. Reading her speech at a press conference on July 23, 1984, she said, "The potential harm to the pageant and the deep division that a bitter fight may cause has convinced me that I must relinquish my title as Miss America. I feel at this time I could expend my energies in launching what I hope will be a successful career in the entertainment business." Her parents knew she'd made a mistake, but didn't think she should resign. She'd gone above and beyond her duties, making extra appearances because she'd made history with her win. Still, they stood behind her. They just wanted her to get through it and move on. Williams got to keep the crown and the money she'd already made from those appearances, but she lost her deal with Gillette, and with it, the respect of many in the pageant community and in the black community. The hate mail started coming again. She was the target of ridicule for tabloids and for comedians like Joan Rivers and Chris Rock. The mayor of Talladega, Alabama, demanded she return the key to the city she received when she was Grand Marshal in its Christmas parade. Her mother wrote him a letter in which he refused. It didn't help that while Williams was suing Guccione for publishing the nude photos without her consent, she had to contend with another Penthouse cover published just months later. That issue contained another set of photos of her taken that same summer with a different photographer. In these images, she appeared in bondage gear. She had left that shoot feeling so remorseful and uncomfortable that she returned to the photographer's apartment with her boyfriend at the time and refused to leave without the negatives. After a struggle, she thought he'd surrendered all of them, but that photographer too would sell them to Penthouse. The cover of that second Penthouse issue, which dropped in January 1985, featured another photo of Williams with burns. Its cover line read, "Oh God, I did it again." Williams' lawyers informed her that her trial against Penthouse and Guccione could drag on, that his team would dig up any dirt on her they could find. Her parents believed she'd been treated unjustly, but as teachers, they didn't have endless funds to pay her legal fees. She knew the tabloids would continue to dog her. As she writes in You Have No Idea, quote, "I wanted it to be over. What were we really winning anyway? I'd be getting publicity for all the wrong reasons. I thought, I'm done." She dropped the suit less than 2 years after she filed it. The experience was painful and mortifying for Williams, the consequences earth-shattering. For years after the scandal, she'd go to meetings or auditions, and she'd feel dismissed before she even opened her mouth. Says Williams,
"I mean, I'd walk into a room for an audition and talking about being judged. Can she act? Do we really want her? Is this just for dinner party conversation that I can say, oh, guess what? I have Vanessa Williams come in. Let me tell you about this audition." So I had no idea who to trust, who was real, who really was going to give me an opportunity, or who was just pure folly.
But she also knew she wouldn't just recede into the background. She'd been raised to push past barriers, sexist, racist, or otherwise. She'd proved to her critics that she wasn't just a sad, dethroned beauty queen or a victim. "You have no idea who I am and what I can do," she recalls thinking in her memoir. "One day the dust will settle and you'll see what I am made of." Up next, after the break, we look at how Williams rose above the shame and backlash to launch a successful singing and acting career and become the most famous Miss America we've ever had.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The holidays have arrived early this year. Why wait until fall when you can get Black Friday prices now during Blinds.com's annual Spring Black Friday sale? Blinds.com's the better way to get custom window treatments totally online. No waiting around all day for salespeople to show up or dealing with inflated showroom prices. Upgrading your window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters, motorized options. We have your patio covered for spring too. And Blinds.com's free design experts will help you find the perfect window treatments for your home. We'll even send free samples. You can even get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Plus, free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now for the best deals of the season. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah!
I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Irish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
The year was 1986. Vanessa Williams had been struggling to move past her pageant controversy and realize her dream of making it on Broadway. So at the advice of her manager, Ramon Hervey, who for a time was also her husband, she decided to pursue a recording career. Through a musical director of an off-Broadway project she'd been involved in, she snagged a gig singing backup on two songs for Parliament Funkadelic's George Clinton. After having worked with the legend, she was able to boost her cred. Singers with musical theater backgrounds were usually a turnoff for record companies. She met Ed Eckstein, general manager of Wing Records, a small division of PolyGram, who instantly took to her. He'd worked under the tutelage of Quincy Jones, so she was in good hands. Williams released her debut album, The Right Stuff, in 1988. Its first two singles were successful on the R&B charts, but its third, the sax-laced ballad, Dreamin', was a hit on the Billboard Hot 100, peaking at number 8. Her music career seemed to be taking off, a blessing since she knew she had a lot to prove as a disgraced beauty queen turned aspiring pop star. For her next LP, Eckstein would push Williams into new terrain. The R&B fare from The Right Stuff had been mostly popular with Black audiences, but like his mentor Quincy Jones had done with acts like Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie, he wanted to help Williams quote-unquote cross over and attract white listeners too. Her second album, The Comfort Zone, came out in August 1991. Its lead single, the dance pop, New Jack Swing-inflected Running Back to You, went to number 1 on the Hot R&B Hip-Hop Songs chart and number 18 on the Hot 100. Its second single, the title track, was also an R&B hit, but it only made it to number 62 on the Hot 100. The Comfort Zone's third single, however, would completely change the course of Williams' career. Save the Best for Last began as an afterthought in 1988. Phil Goldston, who'd penned songs for Celine Dion and Cher, and his songwriting partner, John Lind, who'd worked on Madonna's Crazy for You, were in Los Angeles crafting a track they'd envisioned for Steve Perry. Both of them had been successful, but they had families and bills to pay, and they needed their next hit. During a break from the would-be Steve Perry tune, Goldston started messing around on his dinky little keyboard with what would eventually become the opening lick of Save the Best for Last. Lynn's ears perked up. He wanted to build on it. Says Goldston,
"In 27 minutes, we wrote almost all of the music of the song. When we took that little break, John said, well, you know, what's the title of this thing? So I went through this little black book, and I'm just going through this list of 200 or whatever number it was at that time of handwritten concepts, scraps, actual titles."
He landed on Save the Best for Last. Lynn liked it. It fit with the arrangement they'd whipped up. At the end of the night, Lynn asked Goldston what they'd do with the song, which they would refer to as their Broadway scrap based on the old school nature of the thing. He suggested Goldston take it to Wendy Waldman, who'd been a folk rock singer in the 1970s and written for the likes of Judy Collins, Bette Midler, and Reba McEntire, to get some help with the lyrics. Goldston agreed, but he lived in New York and Waldman was in Nashville, so he had no idea when he'd get around to showing it to her. After a record he'd produced was rejected by a label, Goldston was moping around the house when his wife suggested he get out of town and take his first trip to Nashville. He called Waldman, who loved the idea, and they chose a weekend. He called Lynn and told him the news.
And he said, well, don't forget to take that little scrap with you. And I said, what little scrap? And he said, that one we were working on, Save the Best for Something. And I said, oh, yeah. Okay, I'll dig that one out. So I found the tape with that on, and I put it in my bag, and I brought it with me. I didn't even remember it.
3 days into working with a 9-month pregnant Waldman in Nashville, he played her the quote-unquote scrap. She thought it was fantastic. She asked Goldston what the title, Save the Best for Last, meant.
And I said, well, to me, that title is probably bittersweet and ironic in a way. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, just when I thought that everything was really going well, you left me. She looked at me, she said, you're crazy. It's not about that at all.
In Wallman's interpretation, the title was referring to someone who thought their love interest didn't love them, only to discover at last that they did.
I said, oh, you mean like a Moon and June song? She said, that's right.
Goldstein goes on to explain what a Moon and June song is.
Some songwriters, particularly of my generation, use the term Moon and June song to refer to a relatively simple, not simplistic, but simple song in the Tin Pan Alley tradition with precise rhymes where possible, Moon and June, and a certain almost sweetness to it.
Goldstein says he didn't realize until quite some time later that by characterizing the track that way, he'd inspired its memorable opening lines.
And then one of us, neither of us remembers who, said the first line, sometimes the snow comes down in June. And the other said, sometimes the sun goes around the moon. So there was the Moon in June, just in reverse. And we were off and running.
Goldstein returned to New York thinking that Save the Best for Last was the weakest link of the batch of songs he'd worked on with Waldman. But both his wife and five-year-old son really responded to it. He considered this a sign, so he got to work producing a demo and enlisted Waldman to sing it. They and Lynn thought it had big commercial potential.
We had the song out, as in pitching the song, to three major artists who we really thought were the right call for this. And the good news for all of us is that all three passed.
The three singers who turned it down, Bette Midler, Barbara Streisand, and Whitney Houston. When Ed Eckstein from Williams' label sent Waldman's demo to her, Williams instantly liked it. Eckstein asked Goldstein and Lynn if she could record it, and they decided to give it a shot. Eckstein paired Williams with producer Keith Thomas, best known for his work with gospel titans BB and CeCe Winans. He'd also produced Amy Grant's 1991 hit, Baby Baby. Williams flew to Thomas's studio in Franklin, Tennessee, 20 miles from Nashville, to record Save the Best for Last and four other songs for The Comfort Zone. She recalls him giving her a bag of potato chips before she started to lay down her vocals. He claimed the oil and salt gave his singer's voices an extra oomph. Given the fate of the song, he might have been onto something. Save the Best for Last was released as a single in January 1992, more than 3 years after Goldstein and Lynn started writing it. By March of that year, it had soared to number one on the Billboard Hot 100, where it would find its comfort zone, staying there for five consecutive weeks. It also rose to the top spot on both the R&B and adult contemporary charts. It would become the number four single of 1992. Our Beloved Baby Got Back was number two. The track would also earn Grammy nominations for Best Song, Best Record, and Best Pop Vocal Performance Female. The single, The Comfort Zone, would snag a nom for Best R&B Vocal Performance Female. The album, The Comfort Zone, would go multi-platinum. Before Save the Best for Last became a massive hit, Goldstein's manager had taken him out to lunch at a hot dog stand and told him that given his dry spell and finances, he might want to consider writing jingles. By spring of 1992, his career had started to turn around. He recalls hearing Save the Best for Last for the first time one weekend in a Pathmark in Yonkers, New York, when he was grocery shopping with his 7-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter. Unshaven and wearing an old overcoat, his hair unwashed, he was stooping to the bottom shelf in an aisle to find the low-priced cans of crushed tomatoes when the song came blaring from the sound system. His kids began screaming in delight. He, Lyndon Waldman, had experienced success before, but nothing like this.
It was particularly affirming because it was a song that defied the current marketplace.
Save the Best for Last was a bit of an anomaly among the other number one hits of 1992. Yes, a handful of ballads topped the charts that year. Boys to Men's End of the Road, George Michael and Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, Mariah Carey's remake of the Jackson 5 song I'll Be There, Whitney Houston's remake of Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You. But most of these songs are about rejection or heartache. Save the Best for Last is about someone being friend-zoned. The singer has watched their close pal and love interest get dumped. They've listened as that pal has confided in them. And they've hoped all along that that pal would finally come to their senses and realize the one they should be with has been right under their nose all along. Then, as the lyrics go, "Just when I thought our chance had passed, you go and save the best for last." The pal does, in fact, love them. The pair are going to give it a whirl. The song is one of those rare ballads with a happy ending. It's essentially a rom-com set to twinkly AM radio keyboards, swelling strings, and wispy acoustic guitars. Yeah, it's basically My Best Friend's Wedding if Julia Roberts finally bagged Dermot Mulroney. Galston was right to initially call Save the Best for Last a Broadway scrap. To me, it's always felt a little less like a standard pop song and more like a show tune, which is not a knock. Williams sounds wonderful on it. Composed, restrained, dignified, and in just enough awe of and even a little annoyed with her new boo. Sorry to Bette and Babs, but she was the perfect choice for it. Williams was 33 weeks pregnant with her third child when she performed Save the Best for Last at the 1993 Grammys. She sat on a stool to sing it. Though she didn't take home any awards that night, she certainly felt like a winner. In her mind, she had finally arrived. Her peers, the voting academy, record buyers, the general public, now they too had put the Miss America scandal behind her. As she writes in her memoir, "I wasn't an outsider anymore." Of course, this was only the beginning. Williams continued recording music after the Comfort Zone. Her top five single, "Colors of the Wind," from the soundtrack for the 1995 Disney film Pocahontas, even won the Academy Award for Best Original Song. But she'd arguably become more famous for her acting. Starring with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 1996 action flick Eraser led to more roles, in the 1997 movie Soul Food, and later as the icy Anna Wintour-inspired fashion editor Wilhelmina Slater on the hit ABC show Ugly Betty, for which she'd earn 3 Emmy nominations. She'd also land recurring turns in series like Desperate Housewives and The Good Wife. And she did wind up fulfilling her longtime goal of making it on Broadway, taking over for Cheetah Rivera as the lead in Kiss of the Spider-Woman in 1994, and playing the witch in the 2002 revival of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, which earned her a Tony nomination. Williams recently wrapped her run in the Tony-nominated 2022 Broadway show, POTUS. And now, 40 years after she went before that panel of judges in Atlantic City, she's a judge of her own on the Paramount Plus drag queen singing competition, Queen of the Universe. Up next, after the break, Vanessa Williams joins us to talk about the fallout after the Penthouse scandal, how she regained control of her image, and the legacy of Save the Best for Last.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver. Yeah!
I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger. and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Where Were You in 92. We've been discussing Vanessa Williams and her number one smash, Save the Best for Last. Now it's time to hear from Williams herself. So where were you in 92? Physically, mentally?
In 1992, I was living in Los Angeles in Playa del Rey. I was a mother of two girls and traveling the world promoting The Comfort Zone, which was my second studio album. I did not have big, gigantic producers working with me that were Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and Keith Thomas, for one, who did Save the Best for Last. He was making the transition from working in the gospel Christian range area with BB and CC Wine. And I did most of the album in Franklin, Tennessee.
So you write in the book, when you're discussing reaching this crossroads to make The Comfort Zone, your second album, you say, I still had so much to prove. What was your strategy to have a successful sophomore effort?
Well, what I mean about proving, I always say success is the best revenge. You just never know what life has in store for you. So proving myself meant that I was judged as a beauty queen after I won. I was judged as a scandalous beauty queen after my reign. And people judge. I'd been in show after show. I was a singer, a dancer, an actor, a musician. So to be judged and to have your talent and your intellect negated by being a beauty queen and labeled a scandalous beauty queen, I was always trying to prove myself. Every opportunity I had, it was like, I'm going to prove to you that I can act. I'm going to prove to you that I can sing. I'm going to prove to you that I can dance, that my talent is something that has opened doors for me, but it's not put upon. It's something that I naturally have and have worked on. And then I'm sure a lot of people thought, okay, well, she got lucky with a one hit. Dreaming. Okay, maybe two hits. And then, a Comfort Zone came and it ticked off the box from not only taking me from the R&B world, but also crossing over into the pop world. And again, there are new people that I get to judge you. And like, who's singing this song? Oh, it's the former Miss America that's singing this. Oh, can she do it again? So I think that we all in life are always trying to prove who we are, and we're always judged. And instead of fighting that and getting resentful, you just realize that that's part of life.
And I believe it was Ed Eckstein who said, hey, like, just FYI, if you're going to go in the pop domain, you may leave some of your Black listeners behind who've come for the R&B and the soul, and you got to straddle this now. How were you able to strike the balance and get new fans, keep your dedicated fan base?
Well, I think my dedicated fan base loved me not only for the hits that I had off the right stuff, but because I was a survivor and I symbolized the great comeback. So it was more for my grit and my integrity and the fact that I was going to overcome. And there are people in your lives that are celebrities or that you know their struggles and their paths in life, and you love them for sticking out and proving that through all of it, you got a chance to win. On The Comfort Zone, after having success, I think Ed got a chance to talk to people that were actually willing to give me songs. Ed knew that, okay, now we've proven that she's here to stay, and that opened more doors for people to take me legitimately.
You talk about being judged, and of course, you enter the Miss America pageant, which is inherently all about judging. You've got a panel of judges, but it didn't stop there. You win. I think one of the more distressing passages in the book, you write of the backlash you received, not only from the white community, but from the Black community.
I've had people, when I was crowned, say I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime, which is very similar to, you know, what we said when Obama first became president. But there were people that felt I wasn't Black enough, which again is being judged and assuming that you know somebody's experience. And of course, it hurts your feelings and you say, isn't this enough? And does this discredit even this momentous occasion when you can't even acknowledge the fact that we've made history because of the way that I look? The year 1983 that I won, there were four women of color, which was the most they had ever had, four Black women and one Latino woman. So contestants. And I had a white boyfriend at the time. And again, you know, anger from some Black men that felt that, you know, I having a white boyfriend was saying that I didn't love Black men, which was, you know, again, another criticism, which I was completely having to combat. It was a lot. And again, I look back at my 20-year-old self, 21-year-old self, having been a mother of four children, watching them all go through the same age range. And I marvel at how I got through it.
The letters that your mother received that she writes about in the book, that was just very jarring. I can't believe, in a way, you know, I read it and I was thinking, wow, maybe social media backlash is a good thing because people can't send you letters with some of the contents in the envelopes that your mother had to, you know, unearth.
My parents lived in the house that I grew up in. We had a number that you get back in the phone book. It was listed. So anyone could dial up my house. My parents would pick up. We didn't have caller ID. My parents would pick up the, you know, the rotary phone, and they would get these evil messages that they were accosted by about threats to my life, about horrible racial slurs that were hurled at them, and they had to harbor it or protect me from it to allow me to continue to do my job as Miss America and travel the states every other day, appearance after appearance, and not freak me out. But they would say, oh, you're going to Chicago, be careful. Oh, you're going down to Alabama, watch out. Oh, you know, so they would give me these gentle hints to try to protect me, but not have me freak out because the job was hard enough. At some point, you just have to hand it over and surrender to life and do the best you can, but also be wary.
When the penthouse photos surfaced toward the end of your reign as Miss America, you were given 72 hours to resign by the pageant. And you basically waited until the last hour. You know, you're working with your publicist. And in that last hour is when you decided, okay, I think I will resign. What spurred that decision? Not the 11th hour, but the 71st hour.
There were a big faction of people that wanted me to fight for the crown. Basically, they said, you have... you superseded your obligations. There was no reason to resign. And so even when I reached my press conference, there were people with signs, you know, saying, keep the crown, don't resign, and activated. But at that point, I had a month to go, a month and a couple weeks of vacation that was allotted, and I wanted to get on with my life, you know, and it was tremendously, you know, humiliating and painful and stressful. And again, I think back at the 21 years old, incredibly stressful, but I wanted to move on. And I had had a brilliant reign, whatever. I had had so many opportunities and done the best of my abilities and was very proud of the work that I had done.
I'm looking at the cover of the comfort zone today. And I'm thinking, wow, like this is her emerging. She's wet. She's sultry. And I'm wondering, what were the conversations like with you trying to, of course, put the past behind you, put the scandal of the penthouse photos and Miss America behind you, but also, you know, you were wanted to come across as a, you made that very clear. You were like, I don't want wimpy ballads. I don't want to be pleading with men. I want to be a very confident woman. So how did you navigate that?
There were so many perceptions of my image. Miss America is very straight-laced. Scandalized Miss America was very scandalous. Is she soulful enough? Is she too middle of the road? So I wanted to make sure that my image was strong. Again, I was middle 20s, provocative. Great. I was still dancing and in great shape. And also confident and approachable.
You, of course, scored big with Save the Best for Last. And you felt something. You know, you write in the book, I got chills from hearing the demo. But you had no idea it was going to be the sort of hit that it was. When did you know that it was massive?
When I recorded it in Nashville or Franklin, Tennessee with Keith, I remember recording it. We're like, we're going to get this in one take. And when you, and back then there's no auto tune. So you hear someone's real voice, the real timbre, the real breaths. When you hear the purity of a voice making mistakes or not being actually completely correct digitally, there's a magic there because you think that you're hearing it for the first time and you think that you're listening to it to actually somebody perform it. So I knew that we were going to get it in one take. That was our mission. And I knew that Keith and myself and Ed and my husband at the time was my manager. We knew that we had something special. I had no idea it would last in the number one spot for so long.
Did you do it in one take then? You did it in one take.
Yeah, yeah. Then people say, well, that can't be true. So every time I performed it after that, it was like, oh, let's see if, you know, there's some tricks in that bag. You know, so, and to this day, people, when I sing it, people say, oh my God, you sound just like the record. I was like, that's good. Because I sang it on the record. There are no tricks.
I love it. I think at the Grammys, the 93 Grammys, when you performed it, I think you were 33 weeks pregnant.
I think
not only can I do it in one take, I can do it 33 weeks pregnant in one take. If you could sum it up, what do you think the legacy of Save the Best for Last is?
Well, the constant feedback I get from people that approach me is that song changed my life, or that was our wedding song because that was our story. And what I think my superpower is as a performer, I tap into my acting ability. So before I approach the mic, what is my before and what am I bringing? What story do I want to tell? And it's not vocal acrobatics and how loud, how many riffs I can do. It's like, let me bring you into this moment and let me paint a picture. And that's what the consistent feedback is from Save the Best for Last. It's that human connection with being ignored, being there all the time, and you finally see who I am. And, you know, whether it's getting married or being best friends, you finally see it. And also the melody. I thank, you know, Wendy and Phil and John, because melody is, that's that haunting thing. That's the earworm. That's the thing that you can sing along to and you can't forget it, but it also creates that visceral reaction in your body that takes you back to the first time that you heard it or takes you back to that first relationship that you connected with. So I think that's the magic.
Much like Save the Best for Last, this story has a happy ending. In 2016, Williams was tapped to be head judge of the Miss America pageant. During the ceremony, Sam Haskell, the Miss America CEO at the time, joined her on stage to offer a public mea culpa. I want to apologize for anything that was said or done that made you feel any less than the Miss America you are and the Miss America you always will be, he said. Nice gesture, but she hardly needed it. In a sense, being pressured to give up that title of Miss America back in 1984 may have been one of the best things that ever happened to Williams. And her deciding to resign may have been one of the best decisions she ever made. It took guts and was sort of badass, and it led her exactly where she needed to be. If she felt betrayed and humiliated by the scandal, it only made her want to fight harder to put the whole mess, including a victory she never really wanted, behind her and become something bigger. And she did. How many Miss Americas can you name? I admit this is not my world, but I can name one. Today, more than ever, beauty pageants seem like a degrading, sexist, hypocritical thing of a distant past. Be kind of naked, but not too naked. Be sexy, but not sexual. Be confident, but also cute and coy. Smile more. Even if Miss America ditched its swimsuit competition in 2018 and announced it would no longer judge contestants on their physical appearance, sure, audiences today would much rather watch RuPaul's Drag Race, on which Williams has also served as a judge. A wildly popular competition show turned total empire, it is, at least partly, a commentary on the ridiculous standards of beauty to which many women still feel beholden. And it's also a satire of the artifice and goofy, over-the-top camp nature of pageants. Just think of all those Miss Universe memes that have been making the rounds recently. The jig is up. Meanwhile, Save the Best for Last lives on, says one of its writers, Phil Goldston.
So last year, I decided to do a search and see how many recordings there are of Save the Best for Last, and there are more than 80 out there in the marketplace.
A wedding classic, a go-to drag number, the stuff of a Delilah listener's dreams. The song has become something bigger than what it was ever intended to be. That's because the story of Save the Best for Last is the story of Vanessa Williams.
I think that for those familiar with Vanessa's story, it is not only a comeback story, it's a story of triumph for a person unfairly disparaged, demeaned by everything from sexism to racism and a lot in between. Where, say, the best for last is concerned, what I think is particularly meaningful is that the song is about the surprises that can come your way in life if you're open. And if you embrace them, the glory that can be yours and the happiness that can be yours. And I think that's what happened to Vanessa. And that's most certainly what happened to the three of us who wrote the song.
Where Were You in 92 was a production of iHeartRadio. The executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog. The show was researched, written, and hosted by me, Jason L'Enfier, with editing and sound design by Michael Alder June. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Turns out, a delightfully clean home can make for a delightful start to the day. At Mrs. Meyer's, everything they make is inspired by the garden. With plant-derived and other thoughtfully chosen ingredients, their cleaning products smell like a dream and work like the dickens, leaving your home sparkly clean and your to-do list tackled in no time. Goodness, there's no better feeling than that. Mrs. Meyer's. rooted in goodness. Visit MrsMeyers.com today.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Want to increase your salary? Discover your earning potential with CareerBuilder. CareerBuilder.com knows you have superpowers that make you good at your job. They're called skills, and CareerBuilder.com has tools specially designed to help you move up, like CareerBuilder CoLab. Check out resume examples, learn what recruiters are looking for, search salaries, and view different career paths based on your skills. You'll be amazed to know how many ways you can use the skills you already have to build your future. Visit CareerBuilder.com.